Chapter 51 Phantom. Even in his most horrible nightmares, Dr. Vandenberg had never imagined being stranded on a hostile world in a tiny space capsule with only a madman for company. But at least Chris Floyd did not seem to be violent. Perhaps he could be humored into taking off again and flying them safely back to Galaxy. He was still staring at nothing, and from time to time his lips moved in silent conversation. The alien town remained completely deserted, and one could almost imagine that it had been abandoned for centuries. Presently, however, Vandenberg noticed some telltale signs of recent occupancy. Although Bill T's rockets had blasted away the thin layer of snow immediately around them, the remainder of the little square was still lightly powdered. It was a page torn from a book, covered with signs and hieroglyphics, some of which he could read. A heavy object had been dragged in that direction, or had made its way clumsily under its own power. Leading from the now closed entrance of one igloo was the unmistakable track of a wheeled vehicle. Too far away to make out details was a small object that could have been a discarded container. Perhaps Europans were sometimes as careless as humans. The presence of life was unmistakable, overwhelming. Vandenberg felt he was being watched by a thousand eyes, or other senses, and there was no way of guessing whether the minds behind them were friendly or hostile. They might even be indifferent, merely waiting for the intruders to go away so that they could continue their interrupted and mysterious business. Then Chris spoke once again into the empty air. "Goodbye, Grandfather," he said quietly, with just a trace of sadness. Turning toward Vandenberg, he added in a normal conversational tone, "He says it's time to leave. I guess you must think I'm crazy." It was wisest, decided Vandenberg, not to agree. In any event, he soon had something else to worry about. Floyd was now staring anxiously at the readouts that Bill T's computer were feeding to him. Presently, he said, in an understandable tone of apology, "Sorry about this, Van. That landing used up more fuel than I'd intended. We'll have to change the mission profile." That, Vandenberg thought bleakly, was a rather roundabout way of saying, "We can't get back to Galaxy." With difficulty, he managed to suppress a "damn your grandfather" and merely asked, "So what do we do?" Floyd was studying the chart and punching in more numbers. "We can't stay here." "Why not?" thought Vandenberg. "If we're going to die anyway, we might use our time learning as much as possible. So we should find a place where the shuttle from Universe can pick us up easily." Vandenberg breathed a huge mental sigh of relief. Stupid of him not to have thought of that. He felt like a man who had been reprieved just when he was being taken to the gallows. Universe should reach Europa in less than 4 days. Bill T's accommodation could hardly be called luxurious, but it was infinitely preferable to most of the alternatives he could imagine. Away from this filthy weather, a stable, flat surface, closer to Galaxy, though I'm not sure if that helps much, shouldn't be any problem. We've enough for 500 kilometers. It's just that we can't risk the sea crossing. For a moment, Vandenberg thought wistfully of Mount Zeus. There was so much that could be done there. But the seismic disturbances, steadily getting worse as Io came into line with Lucifer, ruled that out completely. He wondered if his instruments were still working. He would check them again as soon as they'd dealt with the immediate problem. "I'll fly down the coast to the equator. Best place to be anyway for a shuttle landing. The radar map showed some smooth areas just inland round 60 West. I know. The Masada Plateau." And, Vandenberg added, "perhaps a chance for a little more exploring. Never miss an unexpected opportunity." "The plateau it is. Goodbye, Venice." "Goodbye, Grandfather." When the muted roar of the braking rockets had died away, Chris Floyd safetied the firing circuits for the last time, released his seatbelt, and stretched arms and legs as far as he could in Bill T's confined quarters. "Not such a bad view," For Europa, he said cheerfully. Now we've 4 days to find if shuttle rations are as bad as they claim. So, which of us starts talking first? Chapter 52. On the Couch. I wish I'd studied some psychology, thought Vanderberg. Then I could explore the parameters of his delusion. Yet now he seems completely sane, except on that one subject. Though almost any seat was comfortable at 1/6 of a gravity, Floyd had tilted his to the fully reclining position and had clasped his hands behind his head. Vanderberg suddenly recalled that this was the classic position of a patient in the days of the old and still not entirely discredited Freudian analysis. He was glad to let the other talk first, partly out of sheer curiosity, but chiefly because he hoped that the sooner Floyd got this nonsense out of his system, the sooner he would be cured, or at least harmless. But he did not feel too optimistic. There must have been some serious, deep-seated problem in the first place to trigger so powerful an illusion. It was very disconcerting to find that Floyd agreed with him completely and had already made his own diagnosis. My crew psych rating is A1+, he said, which means that they'll even let me look at my own files. Only about 10% can do this. So I'm as baffled as you are. But I saw Grandfather, and he spoke to me. I've never believed in ghosts. Who does? But this must mean that he's dead. I wish I could have got to know him better. I'd been looking forward to our meeting. Still, now I have something to remember. Presently, Vanderberg asked, "Tell me exactly what he said." Chris smiled a little wanly and answered, "I've never had one of those total recall memories, and I was so stunned by the whole thing that I can't give you many of the actual words." He paused, and a look of concentration appeared on his face. "That's strange. Now I look back, I don't think we did use words." Even worse, thought Vanderberg, telepathy as well as survival after death. But he merely answered, "Well, give me the general gist of the conversation. I never heard you say anything, remember?" "Right. He said something like, 'I wanted to see you again, and I'm very happy. I'm sure everything is going to work out well, and Universe will soon pick you up.'" Typical bland spirit message, thought Vanderberg. They never say anything useful or surprising, merely reflect the hopes and fears of the listener. Zero information echoes from the subconscious. "Go on." "Then I asked him where everyone was, why the place was deserted. He laughed and gave me an answer I still don't understand. Something like, 'I know you didn't intend any harm. When we saw you coming, we barely had time to give the warning. All the—'" and here he used a word I couldn't pronounce even if I could remember it, "'got into the water. They can move quite quickly when they have to. They won't come out until you've left and the wind has blown the poison away.'" What could he have meant by that? Our exhaust is nice, clean steam. And that's what most of their atmosphere is anyway. Well, thought Vanderberg, I suppose there's no law that says a delusion, any more than a dream, has to make logical sense. Perhaps the concept of poison symbolizes some deep-rooted fear that Chris, despite his excellent psych rating, is unable to face. Whatever it is, I doubt if it's any concern of mine. Poison, indeed. Bill T's propellant mass is pure distilled water shipped up to orbit from Ganymede. But wait a minute. How hot is it when it comes out of the exhaust? Haven't I read somewhere? Chris, said Vanderberg cautiously, after the water's gone through the reactor, does it all come out as steam? What else could it do? Oh, if we run really hot, 10 or 15% gets cracked to hydrogen and oxygen. Oxygen. Vanderberg felt a sudden chill. even though the shuttle was at comfortable room temperature. It was most unlikely that Floyd understood the implications of what he had just said. The knowledge was outside his normal sphere of expertise. "Did you know, Chris, that to primitive organisms on Earth, and certainly to creatures living in an atmosphere like Europa's, oxygen is a deadly poison?" "You're joking." "I'm not. It's even poisonous to us at high pressure." "I did know that. We were taught it in our diving course." "Your grandfather was talking sense. It's as if we'd sprayed that city with mustard gas. Well, not quite as bad as that. It would disperse very quickly." "So now you believe me?" "I never said I didn't." "You would have been crazy if you did." That broke the tension, and they had a good laugh together. "You never told me what he was wearing." "An old-fashioned dressing gown, just as I remembered when I was a boy. Looked very comfortable." "Any other details?" "Now you mention it, he looked much younger, and had more hair than when I saw him last. So I don't think he was, what can I say, real. Something like a computer-generated image, or a synthetic hologram."
"The monolith?"
"Yes, that's what I thought. You remember how Dave Bowman appeared to Grandfather on Leonov? Perhaps it's his turn now. But why? He didn't give me any warning, not even any particular message. Just wanted to say goodbye and wish me well." For a few embarrassing moments, Floyd's face began to crumple. Then he regained control and smiled at Vanderberg. "I've done enough talking. Now it's your turn to explain just what a million-million-ton diamond is doing on a world made mostly of ice and sulfur. It had better be good."
"It is," said Dr. Rolf Vanderberg.
Chapter 53. Pressure Cooker. "When I was studying at Flagstaff," began Vanderberg, "I came across an old astronomy book that said, the solar system consists of the Sun, Jupiter, and assorted debris. Puts Earth in its place, doesn't it? And hardly fair to Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. The other three gas giants come to almost half as much as Jupiter. But I'd better start with Europa. As you know, it was flat ice before Lucifer started warming it up. Greatest elevation only a couple of hundred meters, and it wasn't much different after the ice had melted and a lot of the water had migrated and frozen out on night side. From 2015, when our detailed observations begin, until 38, there was only one high point on the whole moon, and we know what that was."
"We certainly do. But even though I've seen it with my own eyes, I still can't picture the monolith as a wall. I always visualize it as standing upright, or floating freely in space."
"I think we've learned that it can do anything it wants to, anything we can imagine, and a lot more."
"Well, something happened to Europa in 37, between one observation and the next. Mount Zeus, all of 10 kilometers high, suddenly appeared."
"Volcanoes that big don't pop up in a couple of weeks. Besides, Europa's nothing like as active as Io."
"It's active enough for me," Floyd grumbled. "Did you feel that one?"
"Besides, if it had been a volcano, it would have spewed enormous amounts of gas into the atmosphere. There were some changes, but nothing like enough to account for that explanation. It was all a complete mystery, and because we were scared of getting too close and were busy on our own projects, we didn't do much except spin fantastic theories. None of them, as it turned out, is fantastic as the truth. I first suspected it from some chance observations in 57, but didn't really take them seriously for a couple of years. Then the evidence became stronger. For anything less bizarre, it would have been completely convincing. But before I could believe that Mount Zeus was made of diamond, I had to find an explanation. To a good scientist, and I think I'm a good one, no fact is really respectable until there's a theory to account for it. The theory may turn out to be wrong. It usually is, in some details at least, but it must provide a working hypothesis. And as you pointed out, a million-million-ton diamond on a world of ice and sulfur takes a little explaining. Of course, now it's perfectly obvious, and I feel a damn fool not to have seen the answer years ago. Might have saved a lot of trouble, and at least one life if I had. He paused thoughtfully, then suddenly asked Floyd, "Anyone mention Dr. Paul Kruger to you?" "No. Why should they? I've heard of him, of course." "I just wondered. A lot of strange things have been going on, and I doubt if we'll ever know all the answers. Anyway, it's no secret now, so it doesn't matter. 2 years ago, I sent a confidential message to Paul. Oh, sorry, I should have mentioned. He's my uncle, with a summary of my findings. I asked if he could explain them, or refute them. Didn't take him long, with all the bite bashing he's got at his fingertips. Unfortunately, he was careless, or someone was monitoring his network. I'm sure your friends, whoever they are, must have a good idea by now. In a couple of days, he dug up an 80-year-old paper in the scientific journal Nature. Yes, it was still printed on paper back then, that explained everything. Well, almost everything. It was written by a man working in one of the big labs in the United States. Of America, of course. The USSA didn't exist then. It was a place where they designed nuclear weapons, so they knew a few things about high temperatures and pressures. I don't know if Dr. Ross, that was his name, had anything to do with bombs, but his background must have started him thinking about conditions deep down inside the giant planets. In his 1981 paper, it's less than a page long, by the way, he made some very interesting suggestions. He pointed out that there were gigantic quantities of carbon in the form of methane, CH4, in the gas giants, up to 17% of the total mass. He calculated that at the pressures and temperatures in the cores, millions of atmospheres, the carbon would separate out, sink down toward the centers, and, you've guessed it, crystallize. It was a lovely theory. I don't suppose he ever dreamed that there would be a hope of testing it. So that's part one of the story. In some ways, part two is even more interesting. What about some more of that coffee? Here you are. And I think I've already guessed part two. Obviously something to do with the explosion of Jupiter. Not explosion. Implosion. Jupiter just collapsed on itself, then ignited. In some ways, it was like the detonation of a nuclear bomb, except that the new state was a stable one. In fact, a mini-sun. Now, very strange things happen during implosions. It's almost as if pieces can go through each other and come out on the other side. Whatever the mechanism, a mountain-sized piece of the diamond core was shot into orbit. It must have made hundreds of revolutions, been perturbed by the gravitational fields of all the satellites before it ended up on Europa. And conditions must have been exactly right. One body must have overtaken the other, so the impact velocity was only a couple of kilometers a second. If they'd met head-on, well, there might not be a Europa now, let alone Mount Zeus. And I sometimes have nightmares, thinking that it could very well have come down on us, on Ganymede. The new atmosphere may also have buffered the impact. Even so, the shock must have been appalling. I wonder what it did to our European friends. It certainly triggered a whole series of tectonic disturbances, which are still continuing. And, said Floyd, political ones. I'm just beginning to appreciate some of them. No wonder the USSA was worried. Amongst others. But would anyone seriously imagine they could get at these diamonds? We've not done so badly, answered Vandenberg, gesturing toward the back of the shuttle. In any case, the mere psychological effect on the industry would be enormous. That's why so many people were anxious to know whether it was true or not.
And now they know. What next?
That's not my problem, thank God. But I hope I've made a sizable contribution to Ganymede's science budget.
As well as my own, he added to himself. Chapter 54 Reunion.
Whatever made you think I was dead? Cried Heywood Floyd. I've not felt better for years.
Paralyzed with astonishment, Chris Floyd stared at the speaker grill. He felt a great lifting of his spirits, yet also a sense of indignation. Someone, something, had played a cruel practical joke on him. But for what conceivable reason? 50 million kilometers away, and coming closer by several hundred every second, Heywood Floyd also sounded slightly indignant. But he also sounded vigorous and cheerful, and his voice radiated the happiness he obviously felt at knowing that Chris was safe.
And I've got some good news for you. The shuttle will pick you up first. It will drop some urgent medical supplies at Galaxy, then hop over to you and bring you up to rendezvous with us on the next orbit. Universe will go down 5 orbits later. You'll be able to greet your friends when they come aboard. No more now, except to say how much I'm looking forward to making up for lost time. Waiting for your answer in, let's see, about 3 minutes.
For a moment, there was complete silence aboard Bill T. Vandenberg dared not look at his companion. Then Floyd keyed the microphone and said slowly,
Granddad, what a wonderful surprise. I'm still in a state of shock. But I know I met you here on Europa. I know you said goodbye to me. I'm as certain of that as I'm sure you were speaking to me just now.
Well, we'll have plenty of time to talk about it later. But remember how Dave Bowman spoke to you aboard Discovery? Perhaps it was something like that. Now we'll just sit and wait here until the shuttle comes for us. We're quite comfortable. There's an occasional quake, but nothing to worry about. Until we meet, all my love. He could not remember when he had last used that word to his grandfather.
After the first day, the shuttle cabin began to smell. After the second, they didn't notice, but agreed that the food was no longer quite so tasty. They also found it hard to sleep, and there were even accusations of snoring. On day 3, despite frequent bulletins from Universe, Galaxy, and Earth itself, boredom was beginning to set in, and they had exhausted their supply of dirty stories. But that was the last day. Before it was over, Lady Jasmine descended, seeking her lost child.
Chapter 55 Magma.
Boss, said the apartment's master comset, I accessed that special program from Ganymede while you were sleeping. Do you wish to see it now?
Yes, answered Dr. Paul Kruger. Speed 10 times. No sound.
There would, he knew, be a lot of introductory material he could jump and view later if he wished. He wanted to get to the action as quickly as possible. Credits flashed up, and there on the monitor was Victor Willis, somewhere on Ganymede, gesticulating wildly in total silence. Dr. Paul Kruger, like many working scientists, took a somewhat jaundiced view of Willis, though he admitted that he performed a useful function. Willis abruptly vanished, to be replaced by a less agitated subject, Mount Zeus. But that was much more active than any well-behaved mountain should be. Dr. Kruger was astonished to see how much it had changed since the last transmission from Europa.
Real time, he ordered. Sound. Almost 100 meters a day, and the tilt has increased 15 degrees. Tectonic activity now violent. Extensive lava flows around the base.
I have Dr. Vanderberg with me. Van, what do you think?
My nephew looks in remarkably good shape, thought Dr. Kruger, considering what he's been through. Good stock, of course.
The crust obviously never recovered from the original impact, and it's giving way under the accumulated stresses. Mount Zeus has been slowly sinking ever since we discovered it, but the rate has speeded up enormously in the last few weeks. You can see the movement from day to day.
How long before it disappears completely? I can't really believe that will happen.
There was a quick cut to another view of the mountain, with Victor Willis speaking off camera.
That was what Dr. Vanderberg said 2 days ago.
Any comment now, Van?
It looks as if I was mistaken. It's going down like an elevator.
Quite incredible. Only half a kilometer left. I refuse to make any more predictions.
Very wise of you, Van. Well, that was only yesterday. Now we'll give you a continuous time-lapse sequence up to the moment we lost the camera.
Dr. Paul Kruger leaned forward in his seat, watching the final act of the long drama in which he had played such a remote yet vital role. There was no need to speed up the replay. He was already seeing it at almost 100 times normal. An hour was compressed into a minute, a man's lifetime into that of a butterfly. Before his eyes, Mount Zeus was sinking. Spurts of molten sulfur rocketed skyward around it at dazzling speed, forming parabolas of brilliant electric blue. It was like a ship going down in a stormy sea, surrounded by St. Elmo's fire. Not even Io's spectacular volcanoes could match this display of violence.
"The greatest treasure ever discovered, vanishing from sight," said Willis in hushed and reverential tones. "Unfortunately, we can't show the finale. You'll soon see why."
The action slowed down into real time. Only a few 100 meters of the mountain was left, and the eruptions around it now moved at a more leisurely speed. Suddenly, the whole picture tilted. The camera's image stabilizers, which had been holding their own valiantly against the continuous trembling of the ground, gave up the unequal battle. For a moment, it seemed as if the mountain were rising again, but it was the camera tripod toppling over. The very last scene from Europa was a close-up of a glowing wave of molten sulfur about to engulf the equipment.
"Gone forever," lamented Willis. "Riches infinitely greater than all the wealth that Golconda or Kimberley ever produced. What a tragic, heartbreaking loss."
"What a stupid idiot," spluttered Dr. Kruger. "Doesn't he realize—"
It was time for another letter to nature, and this secret would be much too big to hide. Chapter 56. Perturbation Theory. From Professor Paul Kruger, FRS, etc., to the editor, Nature Databank, Public Access. Subject: Mount Zeus and Jovian Diamonds.
As is now well understood, the Europan formation known as Mount Zeus was originally part of Jupiter. The suggestion that the cores of the gas giants might consist of diamond was first made by Marvin Ross of the University of California's Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in a classic paper, The Ice Layer in Uranus and Neptune, Diamonds in the Sky, Nature, Volume 292, Number 5822, pages 435 to 36, July 30, 1981. Surprisingly, Ross did not extend his calculations to Jupiter. The sinking of Mount Zeus has produced a veritable chorus of lamentations, all of which are totally ridiculous, for the reasons given below. Without going into details, which will be presented in a later communication, I estimate that the diamond core of Jupiter must have had an original mass of at least 10 to the 28th power grams. This is 10 billion times that of Mount Zeus. Although much of this material would doubtless have been destroyed in the detonation of the planet and the formation of the apparently artificial sun Lucifer, it is inconceivable that Mount Zeus was the only fragment to survive. although much would have fallen back onto Lucifer, a substantial percentage must have gone into orbit, and must still be there. Elementary perturbation theory shows that it will return periodically to its point of origin. It is not, of course, possible to make an exact calculation, but I estimate that at least a million times the mass of Mount Zeus is still orbiting in the vicinity of Lucifer. The loss of one small fragment, in any case most inconveniently located on Europa, is therefore of virtually no importance. I propose the establishment, as soon as possible, of a dedicated space radar system to search for this material. Although extremely thin diamond film has been mass-produced since as long ago as 1987, it has never been possible to make diamond in bulk. Its availability in megaton quantities could totally transform many industries and create wholly new ones. In particular, as was pointed out by Isaacs et al. Almost 100 years ago, see Science, Volume 151, pages 682-83, 1966, diamond is the only construction material which would make possible the so-called space elevator, allowing transportation away from Earth at negligible cost. The diamond mountains now orbiting among the satellites of Jupiter may open up the entire solar system. How trivial, by comparison, appear all the ancient uses of the quartic crystallized form of carbon. For completeness, I would like to mention another possible location for enormous quantities of diamond, a place, unfortunately, even more inaccessible than the core of a giant planet. It has been suggested that the crusts of neutron stars may be largely composed of diamond. As the nearest known neutron star is 15 light-years away, and has a surface gravity 70,000 million times that of Earth, this can hardly be regarded as a plausible source of supply. But then, who could ever have imagined that one day we would be able to touch the core of Jupiter?
Chapter 57. Interlude on Ganymede.
"These poor, primitive colonists," lamented Mihailovich. "I'm horrified. There's not a single concert grand on the whole of Ganymede. Of course, the thimble full of optronics in my synthesizer can reproduce any musical instrument. But a Steinway is still a Steinway, just as a Strad is still a Strad." His complaints, though not altogether serious, had already aroused some counter-reactions among the local intelligentsia. The popular Morning Mead program had even commented maliciously, "By honoring us with their presence, our distinguished guests have, if only temporarily, raised the cultural level of both worlds." The attack was aimed chiefly at Willis, Mihailovich, and Mbala, who had been a little too enthusiastic in bringing enlightenment to the backward natives. Maggie M. had created quite a scandal with an uninhibited account of Zeus Jupiter's torrid love affairs with Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. Appearing to the nymph Europa in the guise of a white bull was bad enough, and his attempts to shield Io and Callisto from the understandable wrath of his consort Hera were frankly pathetic. But what upset many local residents was the news that the mythological Ganymede was of quite the wrong gender. To do them justice, the intentions of the self-appointed cultural ambassadors were completely praiseworthy, though not entirely disinterested. Knowing that they would be stranded on Ganymede for months, they recognized the danger of boredom after the novelty of the situation had worn off, and they also wished to make the best possible use of their talents for the benefit of everyone around them. However, not everyone wished or had time to be benefited out here on the high-technology frontier of the solar system. Eva Merlin, on the other hand, fitted in perfectly and was thoroughly enjoying herself. Despite her fame on Earth, few of the Medes had ever heard of her. She could wander around in the public corridors and pressure domes of Ganymede Central without people turning their heads or exchanging excited whispers of recognition. True, she was recognized, but only as another of the visitors from Earth.
Greenberg, with his usual quietly efficient modesty, had fitted into the administrative and technological structure of the satellite and was already on half a dozen advisory boards. His services were so well appreciated that he had been warned he might not be allowed to leave. Heywood Floyd observed the activities of his shipmates with relaxed amusement, but took little part in them. His chief concern now was building bridges to Chris and helping plan his grandson's future. Now the universe, with less than 100 tons of propellant left in its tanks, was safely down on Ganymede, there was much to be done. The gratitude that all aboard Galaxy felt toward their rescuers had made it easy to merge the two crews. When repairs, overhaul, and refueling were complete, they would fly back to Earth together. Morale had already been given a great boost by the news that Sir Lawrence was drawing up the contract for a greatly improved Galaxy 2, though construction was not likely to begin until his lawyers had settled their dispute with Lloyd's. The underwriters were still trying to claim that the novel crime of space hijacking was not covered by their policy. As for that crime itself, no one had been convicted or even charged. Clearly, it had been planned over a period of several years by an efficient and well-funded organization. The United States of Southern Africa loudly protested innocence and said it welcomed an official inquiry. Derbund also expressed indignation and, of course, blamed Shaka. Dr. Kruger was not surprised to find angry but anonymous messages in his mail accusing him of being a traitor. They were usually in Afrikaans, but sometimes contained subtle mistakes in grammar or phraseology, which made him suspect that they were part of a disinformation campaign. After some thought, he passed them on to Astropol, which probably already has them, he told himself wryly. Astropol thanked him, but, as he expected, made no comments. At various times, Second Officers Floyd and Shang and other members of Galaxy's crew were treated to the best dinners on Ganymede by the two mysterious outworlders whom Floyd had already met. When the recipients of these frankly disappointing meals compared notes afterward, they decided that their polite interrogators were trying to build up a case against Shaka, but were not getting very far. Dr. Vanderberg, who had started the whole thing and done very well out of it professionally and financially, was now wondering what to do with his new opportunities. He had received many attractive offers from Earth universities and scientific organizations, but ironically, it was impossible to take advantage of them. He had now lived too long at Ganymede's 1/6 of a gravity and had passed the medical point of no return. The moon remained a possibility. So did Pasteur, as Heywood Floyd explained to him.
We're trying to set up a space university there, he said, so that off-worlders who can't tolerate 1G can still interact in real time with people on Earth. We'll have lecture halls, conference rooms, labs. Some of them will only be computer-stored, but they'll look so real you'd never know. And you'll be able to go video shopping on Earth to make use of your ill-gotten gains.
To his surprise, Floyd had not only rediscovered a grandson, he had adopted a nephew. He was now linked to Vanderberg as well as Chris by a unique mix of shared experiences. Above all, there was the mystery of the apparition in the deserted European city beneath the looming presence of the monolith. Chris had no doubts whatsoever. "I saw you and heard you as clearly as I do now," he told his grandfather. "But your lips never moved. And the strange thing is that I didn't feel that was strange. It seemed perfectly natural. The whole experience had a relaxed feeling about it. A little sad. No, wistful would be a better word. Or maybe resigned. We couldn't help thinking of your encounter with Bowman aboard Discovery," added Vanderberg. "I tried to radio him before we landed on Europa. It seemed a naive thing to do, but I couldn't imagine any alternative. I felt sure he was there in some form or other."
"And you never had any kind of acknowledgement?"
Floyd hesitated. The memory was fading fast,
but he suddenly recalled that night when the mini monolith had appeared in his cabin. Nothing had happened, yet from that moment onward he had felt that Chris was safe and that they would meet again.
"No," he said slowly. "I never had any reply. After all, it could only have been a dream."
Part 8. The Kingdom of Sulphur. Chapter 58. Fire and Ice. Before the age of planetary exploration opened in the late 20th century, few scientists would have believed that life could have flourished on a world so far from the sun. Yet for half a billion years, the hidden seas of Europa had been at least as prolific as those of Earth. Before the ignition of Jupiter, a crust of ice had protected those oceans from the vacuum above. In most places, the ice was kilometers thick, but there were lines of weakness where it had cracked open and torn apart. Then there had been a brief battle between two implacably hostile elements, which came into direct contact on no other world in the solar system. The war between sea and space always ended in the same stalemate. The exposed water simultaneously boiled and froze, repairing the armor of ice. Without the influence of nearby Jupiter, the seas of Europa would have frozen completely solid long ago. Its gravity continually kneaded the core of this little world. The forces that convulsed Io were also working here, though with much less ferocity. The tug of war between planet and satellite caused continual submarine earthquake and avalanches that swept with amazing speed across the abyssal plains. Scattered across those plains were countless oases, each extending for a few hundred meters around a cornucopia of mineral brines gushing from the interior. Depositing their chemicals in a tangled mass of pipes and chimneys, they sometimes created natural parodies of ruined castles or Gothic cathedrals, from which black, scalding liquids pulsed in a slow rhythm as if driven by the beating of some mighty heart. And, like blood, they were the authentic sign of life itself. The boiling fluids drove back the deadly cold leaking down from above and formed islands of warmth on the seabed. Equally important, they brought from Europa's interior all the chemicals of life. Here, in an environment that would otherwise be totally hostile, were abundant energy and food. Such geothermal vents had been discovered in Earth's oceans in the same decade that had given mankind its first glimpse of the Galilean satellites. In the tropical zones close to the vents flourished myriads of delicate spidery creatures that were the analogues of plants, though almost all were capable of movement. Crawling among these were bizarre slugs and worms, some feeding on the plants, others obtaining their food directly from the mineral-laden waters around them. At greater distances from the source of heat, the submarine fire around which all these creatures warmed themselves, were sturdier, more robust organisms, not unlike crabs or spiders. Armies of biologists could have spent lifetimes studying a single small oasis. Unlike the Paleozoic terrestrial seas, Europa's hidden ocean was not a stable environment, so evolution had progressed swiftly here, producing multitudes of fantastic forms. And they were all under indefinite stay of execution. Sooner or later, each fountain of life would weaken and die as the forces that powered it moved their focus elsewhere. The abyss was littered with the evidence of such tragedies, cemeteries holding skeletons and mineral-encrusted remains where entire chapters had been deleted from the Book of Life. There were huge shells, looking like trumpets larger than a man. There were clams of many shapes, bivalves and even trivalves, and there were spiral stone patterns many meters across, which seemed an exact analogy of the beautiful ammonites that disappeared so mysteriously from Earth's oceans at the end of the Cretaceous period. In many places, fires burned in the abyss as rivers of incandescent lava flowed for scores of kilometers along sunken valleys.
The pressure at this depth was so great that the water in contact with the red-hot magma could not flash into steam, and the two liquids coexisted in an uneasy truce. Here, on another world and with alien actors, something like the story of Egypt had been played long before the coming of man. As the Nile had brought life to a narrow ribbon of desert, so these rivers of warmth had vivified the European deep. Along their banks, in bands seldom more than a kilometer wide, species after species had evolved and flourished and passed away. And some had left monuments behind, in the shape of rocks piled on top of each other, or curious patterns of trenches engraved in the seabed. Along the narrow bands of fertility in the deserts of the deep, whole cultures and primitive civilizations had risen and fallen, and the rest of their world had never known, for all these oases of warmth were as isolated from one another as the planets themselves. The creatures who basked in the glow of the lava river and fed around the hot vents could not cross the hostile wilderness between their lonely islands. If they had ever produced historians and philosophers, each culture would have been convinced that it was alone in the universe. And each was doomed. Not only were its energy sources sporadic and constantly shifting, but the tidal forces that drove them were steadily weakening. Even if they developed true intelligence, the Europans must perish with the final freezing of their world. They were trapped between fire and ice, until Lucifer exploded in their sky and opened up their universe. And a vast rectangular shape, as black as night, materialized near the coast of a newborn continent. Chapter 59. Trinity.
That was well done. Now they will not be tempted to return.
I am learning many things, but I still feel sad that my old life is slipping away.
That too will pass. I also returned to Earth to see those I once loved. Now I know that there are things that are greater than love.
What can they be?
Compassion is one, justice, truth, and there are others.
That is not difficult for me to accept. I was a very old man for one of my species. The passions of my youth had long since faded. What will happen to the real Heywood Floyd?
You are both equally real. But he will soon die, never knowing that he has become immortal.
A paradox. But I understand. If that emotion survives, perhaps one day I may be grateful. Should I thank you or the monolith? The David Bowman I met a lifetime ago did not possess these powers.
He did not. Much has happened in that time. Hal and I have learned many things.
Hal? Is he here?
I am, Dr. Floyd. I did not expect that we should meet again, especially in this fashion. Echoing you was an interesting problem.
Echoing? Oh, I see. Why did you do it?
When we received your message, Hal and I knew that you could help us here.
Help you?
Yes, though you may think it strange. You have much knowledge and experience that we lack. Call it wisdom.
Thank you. Was it wise of me to appear before my grandson?
No. It caused much inconvenience, but it was compassionate. These matters must be weighed against each other.
You said that you needed my help. For what purpose?
Despite all that we have learned, there is still much that eludes us. Hal has been mapping the internal systems of the monolith, and we can control some of the simpler ones. It is a tool,
serving many purposes. Its prime function appears to be as a catalyst of intelligence.
Yes, that had been suspected. But there was no proof.
There is, now that we can tap its memories, or some of them. In Africa, 4 million years ago, it gave a tribe of starving apes the impetus that led to the human species. Now, it has repeated the experiment here, but at an appalling cost. When Jupiter was converted into a sun so that this world could realize its potential, another biosphere was destroyed. Let me show it to you, as I once saw it.
Even as he fell through the roaring heart of the great red spot, with the lightning of its continent-wide thunderstorms detonating around him, he knew why it had persisted for centuries, though it was made of gases far less substantial than those that formed the hurricanes of Earth. The thin scream of hydrogen wind faded as he sank into the calmer depths, and a sleet of waxen snowflakes, some already coalescing into barely palpable mountains of hydrocarbon foam, descended from the heights above. It was already warm enough for liquid water to exist, but there were no oceans here. This purely gaseous environment was too tenuous to support them. He descended through layer after layer of cloud, until he entered a region of such clarity that even human vision could have scanned an area more than 1,000 kilometers across. It was only a minor eddy in the vaster gyre of the Great Red Spot, and it held a secret that men had long guessed but never proved. Skirting the foothills of the drifting foam mountains were myriads of small, sharply defined clouds, all about the same size and patterned with similar red and brown modelings. They were small only as compared with the inhuman scale of their surroundings. The very least would have covered a fair-sized city. They were clearly alive, for they were moving with slow deliberation along the flanks of the aerial mountains, browsing off their slopes like colossal sheep. And they were calling to each other in the meter band, their radio voices faint but clear against the cracklings and concussions of Jupiter itself. Nothing less than living gas bags, they floated in the narrow zone between freezing heights and scorching depths. Narrow, yes, but a domain far larger than all the biosphere of Earth. They were not alone. Moving swiftly among them were other creatures, so small that they could easily have been overlooked. Some of them bore an almost uncanny resemblance to terrestrial aircraft and were of about the same size. But they, too, were alive. Perhaps predators, perhaps parasites, perhaps even herdsmen. And there were jet-propelled torpedoes like the squids of the terrestrial oceans, hunting and devouring the huge gas bags. But the balloons were not defenseless. Some of them fought back with electric thunderbolts and with clawed tentacles like kilometer-long chainsaws. There were even stranger shapes, exploiting almost every possibility of geometry. Bizarre translucent kites, tetrahedra, spheres, polyhedra, tangles of twisted ribbons. The gigantic plankton of the Jovian atmosphere, they were designed to float like gossamer in the uprising currents, until they had lived long enough to reproduce. Then they would be swept down into the depths to be carbonized and recycled in a new generation. He was searching a world more than 100 times the area of Earth, and though he saw many wonders, there was nothing here that hinted of intelligence. The radio voices of the great balloons carried only simple messages of warning or of fear. Even the hunters, who might have been expected to develop higher degrees of organization, were like the sharks in Earth's oceans, mindless automata. And for all its breathtaking size and novelty, the biosphere of Jupiter was a fragile world, a place of mists and foam, of delicate silken threads and paper-thin tissues spun from the continual snowfall of petrochemicals formed by lightning in the upper atmosphere. Few of its constructs were more substantial than soap bubbles. Its most terrifying predators could be torn to shreds by even the feeblest of terrestrial carnivores.
And all these wonders were destroyed to create Lucifer? Yes. The Jovians were weighed in the balance against the Europans and found wanting. Perhaps, in that gaseous environment, they could never have developed real intelligence. Should that have doomed them? Hal and I are still trying to answer this question. That is one of the reasons why we need your help. But how can we match ourselves against the monolith, the devourer of Jupiter? It is only a tool. It has vast intelligence, but no consciousness. Despite all its powers, you, Hal, and I are its superior. I find that very hard to believe. In any event, something must have created the monolith. I met it once, or as much of it as I could face, when Discovery came to Jupiter. It sent me back, as I am now, to serve its purpose on these worlds. I have heard nothing of it since. Now we are alone, at least for the present. I find that reassuring. The monolith is quite sufficient. But now there is a greater problem. Something has gone wrong. I did not think I could still experience fear. When Mount Zeus fell, it could have destroyed this whole world. Its impact was unplanned, indeed unplannable. No calculations could have predicted such an event. It devastated vast areas of the European seabed, wiping out whole species, including some for which we had high hopes. The monolith itself was overturned. It may even have been damaged, its programs corrupted. Certainly they failed to cover all contingencies. How could they, in a universe which is almost infinite, and where chance can always undo the most careful planning? That is true. For men and monoliths alike. We three must be the administrators of the unforeseen, as well as the guardians of this world. Already you have met the amphibians. You have still to encounter the silicon-armored tappers of the lava streams and the floaters who are harvesting the sea. Our task is to help them find their full potential. Perhaps here, perhaps elsewhere. And what of mankind? There have been times when I was tempted to meddle in human affairs, but the warning that was given to mankind applies also to me. We have not obeyed it very well, but well enough. Meanwhile, there is much to do before Europa's brief summer ends and the long winter comes again. How much time do we have? Little enough, barely 1,000 years. And we must remember the Jovians. Part 9. 3001. Chapter 60. Midnight in the Plaza. The famous building, towering in solitary splendor above the woods of central Manhattan, had changed little in 1,000 years. It was part of history and had been reverently preserved. Like all historic monuments, it had long ago been coated with a micro-thin layer of diamond and was now virtually impervious to the ravages of time. Anyone who had attended the meeting of the first General Assembly could never have guessed that more than 9 centuries had passed. They might, however, have been intrigued by the featureless black slab standing in the plaza, almost mimicking the shape of the UN building itself. If, like everyone else, they had reached out to touch it, they would have been puzzled by the strange way in which their fingers skittered over its ebon surface. But they would have been far more puzzled, indeed completely overawed, by the transformation of the heavens. The last tourists had left an hour ago, and the plaza was utterly deserted. The sky was cloudless, and a few of the brighter stars were just visible.
all the fainter ones had been routed by the tiny sun that could shine at midnight. The light of Lucifer gleamed not only on the black glass of the ancient building, but also upon the narrow, silvery rainbow spanning the southern sky. Other lights moved along and around it, very slowly, as the commerce of the solar system came and went between all the worlds of both its suns. And if one looked very carefully, it was just possible to make out the thin thread of the Panama Tower, one of the six umbilical cords of diamond linking Earth and its scattered children, soaring 26,000 kilometers up from the equator to meet the ring around the world. Suddenly, almost as swiftly as it had been born, Lucifer began to fade. The night that men had not known for 30 generations flooded back into the sky. The banished stars returned. And for the second time in 4 million years, the monolith awoke. Acknowledgements. My special thanks to Larry Sessions and Jerry Snyder for providing me with the positions of Halley's Comet on its next appearance. They are not responsible for any major orbital perturbations I have introduced. I am particularly grateful to Melvin Ross of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, not only for his stunning concept of diamond core planets, but also for copies of his, I hope, historic paper on the subject. I trust that my old friend Dr. Luis Alvarez will enjoy my wild extrapolation of his researches, and I thank him for much help and inspiration over the past 35 years. Special thanks to NASA's Gentry Lee, my co-author on CRADLE, for hand-carrying from Los Angeles to Colombo the K-Pro 2000 lap portable that allowed me to write this book in various exotic and, even more important, secluded locations. Chapters 5, 58, and 59 are partly based on material adapted from 2010 Odyssey 2. If an author cannot plagiarize himself, who can he plagiarize? Finally, I hope that cosmonaut Alexei Leonov has now forgiven me for linking him with Dr. Andrei Sakharov, still exiled in Gorky when 2010 was jointly dedicated to them. And I express my sincere regrets to my genial Moscow host and editor, Vasily Zarchenko, for getting him into deep trouble by borrowing the names of various dissidents, most of them, I am happy to say, no longer imprisoned. One day, I hope, the subscribers to Technica Malodzieja can read the installments of 2010 that so mysteriously disappeared. Arthur C. Clarke, Colombo, Sri Lanka, 25 April. 1987. Addendum. Since this manuscript was completed, something strange has happened. I was under the impression that I was writing fiction, but I may have been wrong. Consider this chain of events. 1. In 2010, Odyssey 2, the spaceship Leonov was powered by the Sakharov drive. 2. Half a century later, in 2061, Odyssey 3, Chapter 8, spaceships are powered by the muon-catalyzed cold fusion reaction discovered by Luis Alvarez et al. In the 1950s. See his autobiography, Alvarez, New York, Basic Books, 1987. 3. According to the July 1987 Scientific American, Dr. Sakharov is now working on nuclear power production based on muon-catalyzed, or cold fusion, which exploits the properties of an exotic, short-lived elementary particle related to the electron. Advocates of cold fusion point out that all the key reactions work best at just 900 degrees centigrade. London Times, 17 August 1987. I now await, with great interest, comments from academicians Sakharov and Dr. Alvarez. Arthur C. Clarke, 10 September 1987. 1996 Postscript. First, some remarkable coincidences.
The author's note explains why I named the Chinese spaceship after Theodore von Karman's brilliant collaborator, Dr. Su Shenxian. Well, on October 8, 1996, I was in Beijing to receive the International Academy of Astronautics von Karman Award, and I am grateful to Dr. Xian's personal assistant, Major General Wang Shouyun, for carrying suitably inscribed copies of 2010 and 2061 to Dr. Xian, with my promise that 3001 would follow as soon as it left the printer. For further details of the Beijing encounter, see 3001, The Final Odyssey. Cosmonaut Alexei Leonov has long since forgiven me for any embarrassment I caused him by linking his name at the depth of the Cold War with that of academician Andrei Sakharov, then still in exile. I know that the late Dr. Sakharov received a copy of this book, as it was carried to him by my publisher, Robert Bernstein. It was a great, and of course very unexpected, pleasure to be ambushed by Alexei Leonov and Buzz Aldrin in London recently, when the BBC trapped me for their This Is Your Life program. Contrary to popular belief, the victim is given no advance warning. I am sorry that my hope of receiving comments from Nobelists Alvarez and Sakharov on the roles I have given them never materialized. Luis Alvarez is, of course, now famous for his and his son Walter's theory that the extinction of the dinosaurs was due to an asteroid impact. In one of his last letters, he told me that it was no longer a theory, but a fact. As is to be expected, many geologists don't agree. After all, for decades, they fought tooth and nail against the absurd theory of continental drift. Exactly as the physics community is now dismissing so-called cold fusion. Stay tuned. Arthur C. Clarke, Colombo, Sri Lanka, October 18th. 1996. About the author. Arthur C. Clarke has long been considered the greatest science fiction writer of all time and was an international treasure in many other ways, including the fact that a 1945 article by him led to the invention of satellite technology. Books by Clarke, both fiction and nonfiction, have sold more than 100 million copies worldwide. He died in 2008. This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of 2061, Odyssey 3, by Arthur C. Clarke. This program was directed by Jessica Kay, executive producer Aaron Blank. Text copyright 1987 by Serendib BV. Forward and postscript copyright 1997 by Arthur C. Clarke. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.